Welcome to What's Your Poison Season 3. Go to johnsavage.com to see all of the other episodes. Please rate it on the Apple or Spotify podcast. Hear me out. Rate it. It does make a big difference. Rate it. Hope you enjoy. Wow, 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 wow. John Savage is back. It's What's Your Poison? Third season, 58th episode. I think that's right. Might be 66th episode. Third year doing What's Your Poison? The podcast where just drink whiskey, talk shit. But I'm going to try up my game a little bit. I've had a lot of fun the last couple of years, but I'm looking at my guest list, and I want to start doing some really small, special guests. And then also following up, well, you know, at the end of each podcast, I always ask somebody, wait a second, did I say Happy New Year? Happy New Year. I always ask the guests to suggest someone I should have on the podcast, but then I never follow up. This time I'm gonna. I'm getting all into comedians, international guests, and more music stuff. I'm expanding my horizons, and I'm actually doing, it's a big step for me, a mild bit of research this time around. I want it to be a bit more quick fire at some point, a little bit more fun at times. I don't know if I'm still getting it together, but I'd love to get input from you if you think these things are too long, too short, or what you'd like to have from the guests. But you should see a dramatic growth in this. Oh, who cares? It's just drinking whiskey, talking to people. I'm very happy to be back. Took a little while to get started, partially because I was doing a deal with Comedy Central, and we were going to launch with Comedy Central, but it didn't happen, so now I'm doing it without him, probably for the best anyway. First guest of 2022, Season 3, my lovely and wonderful friend Kurt Skunrad. Now, Kurt and I, we go way back because we'll bring it up on this years ago. Kurt I made a movie with Meg Rickards. Well, she made a movie, I produced it. It was a short film, very hectic, about a street kid in Cape Town. And Kurt played one of the gangsters, and it was an unforgettable sort of experience because I remembered the moment we were shooting on film back in those days. So the moment, this, we're talking like 2000, 2001, around then. Kurt just lit up on camera. Like, he looked amazing. He was a natural actor. And even though he's one of the great stand-up comics, he was magnetic on the screen. And many, many years later, when I made my movie Stone Cold Jane Austen, he was an undoubted... There weren't really any actors in Stone Cold because I couldn't afford any. I didn't have a budget. So Rob Van Vuren was the only really paid actor, and the only other actual actor in the whole film was Kurt, who played the baddie, the cop, and he was awesome in that as well. And other than that, we've just, you know, we've tried to be two harebrained monsters trying to get stuff off the ground. A lovely soul, a legendary comic. He started the Cape Town Comedy Club, which is obviously iconic, and I just wanted to start Season 3 with someone I really love and someone very special. I hope you enjoy this. What's Your Poison? What did I say? Third season, episode 60-something, year 3. This is Kurt Skunrad. Dig it. Look at that beautiful face. Hello, hello.
I can't see shit.
Hello, hello.
My good man.
All grown up.
I can see you now, bro. You know, it's like when you're in your late 40s. My arm's too short and I can't see so like, you know.
You look good in glasses, bro. It's actually, what's your favorite? Okay, we'll do that next. Second of all, and starting off, beginning at the end, but moving to the beginning. Sweet. Hello and welcome. I love, so I just want to let you know, this is my first episode of the year, the beginning of Season 3 of What's Your Poison. And I'm so excited that I'm doing it with you.
I'm so excited that you asked me, bro. Oh. I don't have a lot of interaction anymore.
Who does? This is COVID. Well, I started this during lockdown to pretend that drinking and chatting to people was still a thing.
Well, you know, I didn't realize that when you said "What's your poison?" It's actually you're allowed to have a drink on this with any amount of respect, you know. So I took the liberty of putting it in a coffee cup, but it's whiskey though.
Ah, okay. Well, I'm going to pour my. What whiskey are you drinking? That's important. That's part of the storyline.
Oh, fantastic! All right, I'm become a bit of a weenie, so I'm drinking a Baines whiskey, bro.
You know what? That Baines is really good, actually.
Not too shabby at all. I'm digging it, bro.
They've just won one of the Baines has just been considered like one of the world top whiskeys in a certain price bracket, and I just saw on the Whiskey Brother website that for like 3 months in a row, the top selling whiskey through there is Baines.
Man, I am a fan. I've had it for a while now, and it's worth the time and the energy. It's a nice soft whiskey. It's nothing too hectic. I do have a bottle of single malt in the wine cabinet there, just in case. I do like myself a nice. There's an alternative. I like a nice peaty, like fat whiskey especially as the first one for the night. You know what I mean?
Well, after what you got
the
in
third
there?
One, I got Glenmorangie.
Glenmorangie.
Is my single malt over there. Ah, that looks fabulous, bro. That looks very Lonnie there, dude.
This is a bourbon.
Oh, that's an American whiskey, is it now?
It is. So I didn't go all local like you did. So I'm shamed. Thank you. Start off my podcast getting shamed.
It's an absolute pleasure. Don't mention it, bro. You got to buy local there, dude.
The
pleasure's all mine. Thanks for having me, bro.
Yay. To this fucking crazy movie called Azare.
Did you see it, bro?
Yeah.
But this was 25 years ago, right? When last did you see that movie, bro?
Well, I'll tell you what. I found it recently because it isn't anywhere. It's very hard to actually find in the world. It's not on.
Yeah.
Have you seen it recently?
Man, I'd love to see it again. I've seen it like years ago when Meg Records just wrapped it up. But I haven't seen it since. That's like 20 years ago, bro.
Bro, I'll send it to you. I'll tell you a
story. You must.
My memory of that movie was, so first of all, I was producing it. Meg was directing. It was her baby. But it was I was a light teen. It was my first experience of becoming an overzealous producer because we had a massive, massive, massive fight on that film. And
really?
The massive fight was, I'm remembering it while I speak about it. Do you remember that the Brasa Funny Cop were in that film?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
And the one day they came on set and in between scenes they just started performing. And we filmed it just for fun. And Meg decided, and credit to her, I was a crazy person. She put it in the film, this like impromptu Brasa Funny Cop rapping scene. But the problem was, if you remember, that movie was fucking hectic. And that kid had just been like taken off the street, raped by some guy, left on the side. And then suddenly the movie became a musical with Brasa Funny Cop doing like a rap. And I was like, I love Brasa Funny Cop, but this cannot be in the movie. And she was like, no, I want it in the movie. And I tried to kidnap the thing from the editor, try to get it like fired off the movie. I was like, we can't put this in. It was a crazy experience.
I was completely unaware of this at the time. It was my first appearance in front of a camera in a movie kind of space. So I was a little nervous, as you could well imagine. And it's amazing because just a few weeks ago, a new material, Riyad Musa's new piece was released after like 2 years of sitting on a shelf after it was edited. And I had a nice little piece in that over there as well. And I've just been booked to do another piece. So I'm really chuffed to have had a history of getting in front of the camera. And it all started with you and Meg, group.
I remember, though, you were a fucking natural in front of the camera for film.
I'm lank honored to hear you say that. And thank you for giving us the spin over there, Bru, because, you know, there was another piece. I don't know if you remember this at all, but there was a little piece we shot up in a block of flats in the top of Ob somewhere. And I'll never forget this piece, is that you had a trolley as a dolly, right? And and the camera did a bounce every time you went over a tile. It was one of the funniest pieces I can remember. And it was just such a lekker way to do things. We were a bunch of kids back then. And it was a crap load of fun. I remember that. But your dolly didn't work so lekker.
No, I remember having to use dollies for trolleys. Trolleys for dollies.
Trolleys for dollies, bro.
That's the name of your next stand-up show.
Ah, shit, dude, that's hilarious.
How have you been? This is the next question is, fuck, it's been mad, but how's it been for you?
Fuck it, dude. It has been, man, I've lived a whole lifetime, it feels like it, in 2 years, dude. As you could well imagine, I lost the comedy club. Like, not in the fucking Pick and Pay. I don't have a lease at
the Horticulture. Have you checked aisle 3?
Yeah, well, apparently there's a fuck up in aisle 3, bro. So I lost the comedy club. Well, the building is still there. The building's like a heritage site, so it's been around for a really long time. And, Bro, it's a kind of a blessing in disguise as well, because I was just taking on way too much over there. Towards the end, I had like 40 staff in that place, bro, and I wasn't dealing with the HR issues very well, and it was getting tough, bro. And way before COVID hit, there was a couple of other things that really had me on the ropes, and I was losing sleep about it for like a year before COVID even came along, bro.
We spoke quite a bit because you were always looking to find a way to basically keep the club alive.
Yeah.
I mean, what an amazing legacy that you've done, though, for this country.
Man, I'm chuffed that you feel that way about it. Man, it's wrought with great highs for me, and then staggeringly fucking weird lows, you know. Here's an example. About in 2017, some independent group came into the comedy club and ranked it. We didn't know they were there. They were completely independent, group of American and Australian kind of critics and stuff. Long story short, they rated us number 9 on the list of top 10 comedy clubs in the world, and I was so fucking chuffed with that, bro. That's quite an accolade. And here's the thing is, dude, we you know, Ian Bredenkamp was my publicist at the time, and we spent a lot of time together planning ways around it and how we can get more bums and seats and better advertising, more marketing. And we try to get this recognized by Cape Town Tourism, the waterfront itself, and fucking no one picked up on it, bro. Nobody was even willing to pick up on it. And it just pissed me off so fucking badly, in that you get such a great accolade and then it would have generated a lot of bums and seats had we had an opportunity to get it out the right way and do more with it. But that was not to be, my good man. It was weird, and I still can't explain why it wasn't taken up with the love and warmth I think it deserved, you know. And then there was international kind of publications that had caught wind of it and then wanted to do an interview online, like this type of thing. But there was more interest overseas in this accolade than there was locally. And that was just weird.
This is the sad reality of, I kind of have seen this a lot. I'm sure you have too. It is a weird thing about, I don't know if it's like a self-worth issue. Like just have a general self-worth issue.
Man, it seems as if you only get the kind of, the kudos you need once you've kind of cracked the nod overseas, you know, like the Charlize Theron's and the Trevor Noah's and the Johnny Clegg's and the likes, you know. Once you've cracked the nod overseas and you really kind of knocking the socks off it, then South Africans are exceptionally keen to know you, and politicians are wanting to take ownership and responsibility for your star rise and all of that.
It's not
bullshit,
a lie, dude.
But you know how it is, bro.
I remember very clearly in the cassette days, this was so clear that we were an emerging band, like just coming up. And we were very ambitious. So we decided to do this tour to the UK. And literally we paid for ourselves to get there, played the shittest pubs to two people, did like four gigs around just to figure out the scene. Came back to South Africa as heroes, charting on Five, doing interviews everywhere. And we were like this, like we were loved because of this world tour we'd just done.
But you know, if anything else, Mr. Savage, I've been a big fan of yours. You know how to spin shit, dude. You just shake it loose, you go out there, all guns blazing, fuck it up, you run in there, and you go, ta-da, check what I did there, bro. And then you catch a hook, bro. I love that about you, I always did, and I think it's fantastic, bro. Really, it is.
Tell me about the start of the comedy club. How did you get that fucker up and running?
Man, it was a progressive thing. It took off in stages over a period of about 10 years, you know. It started off with the Cape Town Festival. They needed to showcase some South African stand-up at the Cape Town Festival, and they approached me to produce something. And it only ran for about 10 days during the Cape Town Festival. And then I came back and did it a couple of years on the trot because it was quite successful. It ran at Manenberg's in the waterfront.
Cool.
Excuse me. At old, Clarence Ford's place. And it did very, very well there. Hmm. And then somewhere along the line, we figured that it needed a little more of a footprint in Cape Town on a permanent or semi-permanent basis. And I found this fucking killer room in Albert Road in Woodstock called... what was it called? It was owned by some French guy, but it was this very eccentric little theater, dinner theater type of space. And I went, fuck it, we got to do something here. And we started running Thursday nights there. I mean, like it was a tip den next door type of deal, but we managed to get all the Southern Suburbs whiteys in there. And they loved it.
Hey, they liked it.
Man, you know, listen. you don't admit to liking tick, no matter where you're from. But let's just say they loved the space and it. You know, Cape Town's always had an underground space that that was good and groovy and people loved it. And then, but at some stage, I mean, my sister was running the door at the time and I was like, oh, this is a fuck up. It's just a question of time. It's not even if, it's a when somebody comes in there with a fucking gun and go, you shit, bro. Yeah. So we started to look out for another place already. And then we found the River Club and that was running for about 4 years. On a Thursday night there, and also just rocked. Eventually, it was we got in like 500-600 people in 120 seats. Oaks were sitting outside and watching it on screens, bro, and still paying cover charge to do that. And it was clear that we needed a bigger, more kind of mainstream stand-up space. And then I kind of asked the River Club if we could get a Friday or Saturday, potentially both. And they were like, nah, you know, we've got regulars. We can't just, I'm talking about this fucking Four Oaks at the bar. I'll comp them every week, bro. Just give me the space. Eventually, they were like, nah, I can't do it, eh? And then I walked past the old pump house in the waterfront one afternoon.
I remember when it was the pump house, yeah.
Yeah, I walked past there. And I remember it too. It was one of my first pizza places that had that big fucking dent in the floor where we put the band in there. You remember that? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I walked past there and I just went, that's a great room. I popped my head in. They used it at the time to store the old parking meters that were kind of fucking broken and stuff. And I popped my head in there and I was like, wow, this is one hell of a room, you know? And then I started knocking on some doors at the waterfront, and I think the first three times I approached them, they were like, just go away, okay? Just please go away. And eventually, I think they agreed to a meeting just to shut me up, you know.
That's the only way.
And then I pitched the idea to them, and they were like, "Actually, you might have something there." And after a lot of begging and borrowing and selling muscle cars, but I sold two of my babies, dude, to start that club. Dude.
I want
to
talk about your.
Man, you know you. Man, I sold two.
Yeah. How many did you start off with? That's how many of two of what?
Two of three. Two of three.
See, that's some context. If it was 2 out of 20, I would have felt no sympathy.
Yeah. No. two out of three. Wow. It was a 57 Chevy Ballet that was just, it was restored to the nines, bro. And then I had this Chevy Camaro from 1969, bro, that I had pampered the shit out of for years, dude. It was like in a, and it was like in a dehumidified garage. It never ever got washed. I just wiped it down, bro. And I sold two of those to kind of fund getting the comedy club off the ground. My missus put in a shitload of cash as well. And,
can I just ask you, sidebar, what do you sell one of those collectible cars for?
Well, bro, just to put it into context, they were so nice that in about 8 years ago, when I sold them, I got about 800-900 grand for the two.
You know? Fucking hell. Really?
It was, yeah, bro. That's, I mean, they're worth twice that now, bro.
Oh.
Yeah. It was, wow. But it broke my heart, dude. Yeah, it broke my heart when I watched them just cruise down the road and some other tourist was driving it. I was like,
but that's what you do for your dream, bro.
Man, you know, most people will tell you, yeah, what you don't know from sacrifices. My bro, I sold two of my kids, dude, to start that club. But it was par for the course. I guess we needed to get it off the ground. We needed to get it up and running. And I'm chuffed I did it. You know, I've ticked one halse groot fucking bucket list box there that I would never have been satisfied had I not started that club. And that room was just absolutely perfect for it as well. You know?
Dude, it's such an iconic thing you've done that no one else can or has done. Highlights of its lifespan.
Oh, bro, there were so many, dude. There were just, where do I start? I remember, you know, you walk into the club and you go, what, is that Samuel L. Jackson at table number 5, bro? You know, really? Tracy Morgan from Saturday Night Live is like, is that Tracy Morgan? And then, you know, what's the guy from the Emoji movie, the curly haired guy? I can't remember his name right now. Miller or something or the other. Anyway, also just quite a famous comedian in the States. And bro, he got so fucking drunk, dude. He couldn't get on stage. He almost fell. TJ, that's the guy.
I had to Google it.
Oh, it was a mess, dude. It was a mess. Anyway.
Or did you just point?
No, of course. Listen, you try and get a picture so you can get all the little bits and bobs in the right place. But, you know, it's the thing is you want to be as nice as possible and you don't want to hassle a picture out of them either. But, I mean, I've had some fucking really great moments in my career, period, with like opening for Russell Peters, opening for Paulie Shaw. I got to do some really whacked out shit in my time, dude. So I was really chuffed with that. And then a few years ago, I got to play with a friend of mine who's like a dinkum rock star in Germany, you know. And I was backstage with him at some concert. There's like 20,000 people there. Wow. He goes, bro, do you want to go on and do like 15 minutes?
Oh.
I'm like, fuck yeah. Give me the mic, bro. Give me the mic. And, bro, I had a show at the time I was in Germany doing called Living with a German with another comedian, a German comedian friend of mine. And, man, I got to do 15 minutes to Germans, and they laughed. I think my last line was, I think I can retire now, bro. But the Germans laughed, dude. It was fucking wild.
That is
very, very cool, man.
Amazing. What was the name of the band?
It was Sons of Mannheim, and his name is Zayu. He's like a big deal in Germany. I mean, there were some other things about that particular trip that was like rock star shit straight out the movies, my bro. I mean, I pulled up at his place one day and he went, do you have a car to drive here while you are here in Germany? I said, yeah, I'm driving my in-laws Kashkar, bro. And then he went, no, guy, we've got to make sure you are getting the right car. So he took me to a warehouse full of fucking sports cars, bro. Full,
that's your dream right there.
And exactly, I was like, you should me choose one, bro, choose one. And I was just about to head to the north of Germany with my family and my mother-in-law, you know. And I went, okay, I'll take that Bentley Continental GT there, bro. There you go.
You kidding?
And I had it for months, bro. He came, bro, he had about 50 cars in that warehouse, bro. And it's Porsches and Ferraris and Lamborghinis. And I was like, give me the Bentley, bro. And I had it for a month. My only problem was is I had to put the gas in the car. I think I had to take out a second bond on my house to fund the gas bill, my friend.
Have you got photos of that car?
I do. I've got it somewhere. Yeah, I do. And then he was driving like a Porsche 918 at the time, which was like, it still is one of the best hypercars ever, you know. And I remember like going on the autobahn with like some ridiculous speed at like 3 o'clock in the morning with the circuit. It was wild, man. Rockstar shit, dude. Really, it was unbelievable. Cool. Yeah.
In terms of the comedy club, how much of its life did you film? Have you got that stuff on tape somewhere?
Man, bro, that's another disappointing side of it. We've got a lot of it on tape. We filmed quite a bit of it. We filmed a pilot for a thing called a stand-up show. We are kind of took the bucks. You know how expensive it is to produce something like that proper. We got in a big jib. And for those of you who don't know what a jib is, it's this big arm with a camera on. It makes any room look like Madison Square Garden, you know. So we got the jib in. We got like professional operators with four cameras. And we shot a night there, trying to showcase what the club was about, and was hoping to try to sell it to like a Netflix or for it, you know what I mean? As a stand-up show, as a regular stand-up show. But they were never interested in it. They were. It's one of the same things again. I mean, right now, I'm starting to see Showmax and Netflix Africa has started to see some stuff come through there. Also, Comedy Central shot there at least once or twice a year. So there was quite a bit of stuff, you know, that has been shot there. So it's kind of gone down in the history of the South African stand-up space. And it was a beautiful room. And it's just such a photogenic room. It looked so befuck, bro. It was so cool.
Cheers to you in that fucking place.
Cheers, my bro.
Amazing.
Cheers, guy.
Tell me this amazing and notorious obsession with amazing cars. Where did that start?
Man, my dad was a car guy, I guess, and my grandfather was a car guy. And I remember being in the mix there, and I was helping them bleed brakes as a 10-year-old. Like, pump the brake, bro, and then park there with this big old white steering wheel. And then it became a bit of an obsession after that, and I still have that problem, man. I mean, I got cars my wife doesn't know about, bro. Yeah.
How many cars do you think you have?
Last count about
you have.
Well, last count about 8. Yeah.
Wowzer. Do they just live in storage? It's just like you need to have these cars. They just live.
Well, in all honesty, some of them are complete cars and they're great and they're just about done and all of that. And there's some that are just a bunch of parts that should make up in Trans Am somewhere. You know.
Are you someone who physically can fix a car? You go in there with a screwdriver and a hammer, or? Oh, you paint, or is it you got a team of people?
For the record, you never ever go in there with a hammer, ever. Okay.
Well, just shows how much you see what I do. If I had a car.
There's just certain things.
Kurt, is this the thing you hit?
Yeah. I think I'm going to quote Dave Levinson over here. He's got an old gag that I love to bits about cars. He says, what was wrong with the car? She's cucking the carburetor. She's saying, how often do I have to do that?
That's nice.
No, bro, I tickle the little bits here and there, and I don't mind getting involved in the engine side of things. But there's a couple of things I'll never touch. I'll never touch the electrics. I've done that before, and thank God I had a fire extinguisher in the car at the time.
Make a fire.
Also, V8s take a lot more fuel. They take a lot more power to operate. And when something goes wrong, it goes catastrophically wrong, my bro. So you need – I got two fire extinguishers at any stage underneath the seat or whatever. You know? And I just love – you know, bro, it's, for me, it's like, oh, dude, I don't even have to drive the stuff. I could just sit and stare at it all day and still be quite happy doing that, you know.
Do you
I love
know who
it.
The journeymen? Have you? Do you know who the journeymen are?
Well, you've mentioned them to me in the past.
Oh, I have.
Yes, you have. In fact, just before we touched base over here, it was in the feed that you'd sent me. And you'd sent me a list, or at least, sorry, a listing or a contact number for the journeyman. Essentially, if my memory serves me, they are the guys that get together, that group of folks that are car enthusiasts or motorcycle enthusiasts. And they get together and they share a workshop, if my memory serves, yeah?
They have this killer workshop. Like, it's like out of a movie. It's so big. And they just make cars. What they do is they buy vintage cars. They, like, when I was there, it was all old Minis. And they restore them back to original pristine. And because they have this factory next door that makes machinery, that's what their day job is, they actually, like, make the nuts and the bolts that you can't find anymore. And they...
Wow.
They have the manuals, the physical paper manuals, and they look through the manuals and they say, okay, well, this part's missing, we're going to make it. And they've built Porsches and Ferraris and Minis,
man,
and BMs. They're incredible. And they're kids.
Man, let me give you a little bit of context to why this is such a pertinent part of this conversation, really, is that I shot a pilot to a show called Kurt Loves Cars. I'd like to share that with you at some stage in the near future. And man, it's what it is, though, is it's all the little tricks and bobs and kak I've learned from Going Nowhere Slowly, the thing that made it special, including the South African music. And I've kind of included it into the formula for Kurt Loves Cars because I just wanted to relive some of those pieces again. And excuse me. And the car subject is something that's exceptionally close to my vibe. And I've met literally thousands of South Africans that are exceptionally passionate about the restoration of vintage or classic rare cars. And you'll be shocked to know how many of them are just under your nose here. And I'm not talking about one or two. I'm talking about a guy in Langebaan, for example, that's got 46 of them in his garage, bro. And then there's another guy and another guy and another guy. And somebody's got to showcase this with that same gusto we did Going Nowhere Slowly with, without a script, and just wing it, get to meet these people and showcase it, or kind of frame it with great South African music across the board, from hip hop to kwaito to jazz to soft rock and everything in between. And that's what I'm spending all of my time and energy on right now, is trying to get a sponsor, or let me tell you, that's such an old way to put it, a partner that can see the value in something like that, bro. And with any luck, we'll get it off the ground, because, you know, Going Nowhere Slowly, even, you know, it sat on the shelf for 3 years. Nobody wanted it there. They thought it
I'm
would just.
I'm intimately
won't
connected
work.
To that show now. I don't know if you know. Like, my producer Carl was on that show with you for all those.
Oh, like, of course, I know Carl.
Yeah,
he Carl cut his teeth. I was there when he cut his teeth, bro.
You saw his teeth getting cut.
Oh, God, I saw his teeth getting cut. In fact, the last time we saw each other, I ran into Carl and going, what the fuck are you doing here, bro? He's like, man, producer John's stuff, bro. So, yeah, I know Carl well. And some of the best production guys, camera guys, sound guys, behind the scenes guys.
That was a special team.
Came through that show, bro. Man, I was blessed and just so lucky to be on that show, because it just, not only the travel and the people I got to meet and the experiences I've had, and I mean, shit, dude, I did stuff on that show I would never have done. I'm not the bungee jumping type, bro, but fuck it, I did it.
What an experience, that show. Another legend. That's two massively iconic things you've been a part of. Obviously, Stone Cold, that makes three.
Three. Bro, I don't know if you noticed, I put it on my Instagram page the other day. There was like a still shot of me in full police gear, bro. And I couldn't resist it. I was just like, if only I could be a cop. There's a have a look, bro. And I got a shitload of comments on that on my Instagram page. It was just lovely to be able to get that picture out.
That was
just
a fucking
look at those
crazy
Stone Cold
few days.
It was great. I enjoyed every moment of it.
It's so weird with this car thing. My grandfather was like Mr. Car. He had like a car dealership. He brought Nissan and Datsun. No, he brought Datsun to South Africa. He's the Datsun guy.
What?
So my granny, who was an old, You know, even when she was like in her 70s, she drove one of those, I don't know if you know the Datsun ZX, the red sports car convertible.
Bro, it's like you're talking about a car, of course I know the ZX, bro. That's like a... Yeah,
so that's what they drove. He was the thing, and then my dad, who was that was my mum's dad. My dad grew up on the streets of Coventry, and he used to build gearboxes as a kid to earn pocket money. He used to go. He actually told me that what he used to do is sabotage all these cars as gearboxes back in the old days, and then get paid to go around and fix them. Right. So I come from this lineage of car people, and my kid is car fucking mad. I don't know. All I know is it gets me there. I don't know the difference between two cars. Dude. I've got no car thing. It jumped over me.
Dude, it's also a rabbit hole, dude. Once you start getting interested, you know, 20 years flash by and I'm like, fuck, what happened, bro? And you know how much money I spend on storage, bro? Just storing shit that I've picked up over the years. Car body and some windscreens and some wheels and four engines and somewhere along the line I'm going to use all of this, you know. I hope,
sunglasses, you know. What's that story now?
Man, dude. Yeah,
how many sunglasses?
You must check my collection somewhere along the line, dude. I've got sunglasses, some of the rarest shit in the world, dude. And I've been collecting them for like 20 years.
How close are you now to your sunglasses collection? I want to see your most outrageous and your most valuable and your favorite pair.
Don't go anywhere, bro.
Yeah, this is good. Shall I sing?
I'll sing. All right. So, which one to start off with first, bro?
I was going to do a song about Kurt's sunglasses, but I've... Hold on, let me just put my guitar back.
But you didn't realize that I was that close to it. I'm literally just right next to it. So,
that was very fast. Okay.
That was very fast. Okay. These are Kazal 905s. These are very rare, very expensive. Was probably just a few pairs in the country. But these are very, very rocking.
So hold on, they look amazing. And you polish them every day, and do they have a little home or are they just stuck in a drawer?
They look super big, like those old party sunglasses.
Why are they expensive? Why are they cool?
These were made in West Germany before the wall came down, for example. And these were exceptionally rare back then, and they're exceptionally rare now, and they're worth an absolute fortune. I mean, when I say a fortune, I mean about 12 grand, give and take a bit.
Are those an original pair? They're not a copy or a new version?
No, these are not reproductions. Those are original. This is another Italian handmade pair, which I rock all the time, bro.
I know you in those.
You know me in those. Those are very, very cool.
So what's so special about those?
Those are also Italian handmade stuff. Alberto Ferreira. They're not super rare at all, but they're just very, very cool. These are fucking cool. These are also by a company called Carrera. These are very famous. They were worn by all of the big guys back in the
80s. Oh, I know those ones.
You know those ones.
What are they called? Is it the James Dean ones? No.
No, these are from the 80s. They're called Carreras. What's cool about them is you pop that out over there and you can change the lenses. And they come in like three different sets, from clear ones to dark ones. And I used to wear them on Going Nowhere Slowly. I've got them for a really long time already.
Cool.
And my most outrageous pair is also by a company called Kazal. These were famously worn by a couple of jazz musos. Grace Jones had a pair.
Wow. Okay, no, I love those on you.
those are whacked up, my bro. Just check the arms on those over there. It's like, it's so well made. It's unbelievable. Also, same West German company called Kazal, and they're slightly off as well. They're not completely symmetrical. On purpose, bro.
Oh, that's cool.
And then my most valuable pair is by the company Boeing. You know Boeing, the aircraft company? They co-produce a pair of sunglasses every year with Carrera, and the result is that from the late 70s, early 80s. Wow. It is very, very cool. The detailing on that is un-freaking believable, bro. And yeah, I've got about another 20, 30 pairs over there. But those are the ones that I love the most and the most valuable to me. Anyways. And then I got watches and other stuff that I collect, bro. I like good quality. Just don't make them like they used to shit, you know?
Yeah, my brother always had this idea. When he was a kid, he wanted to start a website called Boys Toys, and all it was nothing sexy. All it was like, because he just loved knives and sunglasses and watches, and that's all he wanted to do was like find vintage shit that guys really love to hunt down and find, and then trade them on his website.
I've got some stuff that I trade on eBay with some other guys if I've got doubles or copies of it, and we trade stuff. And man, there's shit that you will fall off your tree for, bro. You go like, what? That's how valuable that shit is. Man, you know the company Ray-Ban?
Of course.
Of course, the sunglass company. They sold off the brand to the big brand called Luxottica in the early 90s, like Luxottica, 91, somewhere around there. But they never, ever sold the technology. They only sold the brand. So Ray-Bans pre-91 are worth a staggering freaking fortune, bro. Because they are just made like nothing else. They made like tanks, you know. And the newer stuff, they're just not made the same way. There's nothing wrong with them. They look pretty much the same way.
They're just not
But if you have them next to each other, you'll go like, geez, bro, that is a completely different ball of wax that over there. You know, like... Ray-Ban was started with at least the sunglasses, the aviators that old Tom Cruise made famous is like in the late 30s, the American government or the army was like same guys that used to make the scopes for the B-52 bombers were approaching and listen, our guys are blinded up there, bro. Can't you do something? Make a pair of glasses. And that's where they come from, bro. Bausch and Lomb from New York. Those are the oaks of Bolton. And I collect those two. I got a cuckload of those.
I think you have more than 20 or 30 pairs just from that store.
I get carried away, bro. Sorry.
No, this is what I want. This is the shit.
Fantastic. I'm happy that you got it, bro.
Tell me about what's happening in the comedy career stuff. I mean, I just saw today. I mean, I fucking love Dave Levinson, man. What a dude. And he sent that post that was like... It was like funny and not funny. It was like a really serious post, but done in that dark, fucked up way that only Dave can do.
I know it well, yeah.
Essentially saying, from what I read, like at first I was like, this is a joke, but then he throws in a few things because I think Dave's brand of comedy is raw shit. Like he knows how to fucking take a dagger, stick it into his own heart, pull it out and show you it's there, and then laugh, right?
So indeed.
In that message he says... Listen, I love comedy, but shit's fucked up. I've just done my degree in, what do you call it?
Real estate business. What's it? Realty.
And then if anybody needs a house, like, here's my number, right? That's a real flag in the ground for where things are at the moment. So I'd love to know where you are, because that's tricky.
Bro, it's a very tricky space at the moment, and it's I've got to count my words very carefully over here. Man, it's how do I put this nicely? A large portion of our comedy business was culled during this COVID thing. Without venues, without audiences, and please don't tell me that the online spaces and audience, because it's not. It's just not the same. There's no feedback. There's no understanding as to what it is.
Thanks. The people watching this are busy saying, fuck you.
Running lines. No, this is great. This is a chat. Stand up.
I'm joking.
Stand up. I need to feed off what's going on around us. Yeah, you know what I mean? And so it's been great for some acts. And also there's a migration to like a social media space for comedy, for stand-ups, really. And some guys have engaged with that immensely, and it's done wonders for their careers and their potential to get booked for big gigs and all of the rest of that. But that doesn't make them good comics, you know what I mean? And Dave and myself, for example, we're into the craft of stand-up, you know, the polish that goes onto it that makes it fucking sexy on stage where you don't even know how you're being tickled, but you are. So in some ways, I feel like the standard of South African comedy has slipped a little bit. Don't get me wrong, there's some fantastic young new acts that are doing phenomenal stuff. But I also have noticed a large portion of newer stand-ups that have taken onto the social media space more than the craft of stand-up. And they sell themselves as stand-ups. But they're more influencers than stand-ups, really, you know. And I mean, they sell out stadiums, some of them, you know. But I remember at the comedy club, for example, we often got the request, hey, man, we've got this fantastic comedian who is huge on Insta. Would you put him on stage? Right? And I used to go, at first, I was like, fuck, let's have a squiz and see what guy's like, you know, bring him over there. And, bro, there's no second take on stage, dude. There is no let's do it over again. Let's try, fuck it, bruh. If you're going down in smoke, you're going down in fucking smoke. And there's no one you can call up there, you know? And here's the weirdest thing is, one would think that if things are going shit on stage, you just get off. Nah, bro. What you do is you look for one laugh so you can leave. But the longer you're on, the less likely it is to come, you know? You just keep going. You're like, fuck, we can throw me something here. Throw me. And eventually, 15 minutes into it, I'm backstage going, cut his mic. Fuck it. Cut the mic. Yeah. Cut it. Fuck, get him off there.
On fire, guys.
Something. Get him, fire extinguisher, something. Get him off there. Because, you know, whoever is hosting that, whoever's got a headline there, has got to go back out there and get them back. And, you know, Dave Levinson's a legend that way. Dave's the kind of act that will go up there after that guy's fucked up madly. Dave will go, come on, guys, clap, clap, or I'll fucking bring him back, eh? Clap.
That's beautiful.
And, you know, this is it. You know, there's a very strict honesty rule in stand-up, and you've got to call a spade a spade. If there's the elephant in the room cannot be ignored, bro. It's got to be called out and go, fuck, check that elephant out. And Dave is a legend at not missing any elephant, big or small, bro. Yeah,
it's interesting. I interviewed Vion. I don't know if you know Vion. He's like the biggest TikToker in the world. He's just one of the top. He's a South African magician.
Oh yeah, no, sorry, I didn't know him. No,
he's this young kid from South Africa. Now he's got like 12 million followers on TikTok, right? And what is interesting though about what you're saying is that he was a magician before. But when he discovered TikTok, he found it to be its own environment where he's got the biggest magicians in the world following him, but they're always chastising him, saying, that's not real magic. That's not how you do a magic show. And I asked him in the show, if you got given like the Vegas stage, would you take it? He said, absolutely not. He recognizes that his environment is 1 minute in this little box. And that being on the – that's a different animal. He's not ready.
I like him already. He's a smart kid because he's figured out that the two things are completely different. They might share the magic thing in common. Mm. But the truth of the matter is that there's a stage side to things in this performance side of things. And it takes years and years to get that down, to put enough polish on it that it looks completely natural and – you're not trying a single thing. You're just fucking nailing it. And that doesn't come easy, bro. I've been around long enough to know that that takes a really long time. That craft takes a long time to put polish on there. And there's a couple of acts in this country. Dave Lev, one of them. This like Nick Rabinowitz has done exceptionally well with that as well. Mark, Stuart Taylor, the David Cows, and these guys have done it for Riyad Musa is a great example as well. These guys have polished that craft for 20 years. Alan Committee, good example too. They put on, this is craft, It's been polished for a really long time. And when you put that up there next to an amateur, you can spot it a mile off.
Oh, yeah. Well, you said it earlier. Yeah. These young kids, well, I don't want to say these young kids, feeding the audience, feeling the audience and being able to respond in real time is the art form that you're explaining.
It is. It is the art form indeed. Man, listen, you don't want to knock any of the other additions to the comedy space that have become very apparent in the last couple of years. And they serve an important part. They really help get the bums on seats in ways I've never seen before. Mm-hmm. Back in, you know, when I started out, a poster on a pole was the only way to do it. You know, if you're lucky enough, you get into like a morning television show or you get into a radio station and they come in as a media sponsor and then you've just knocked it out of the park. Nowadays, you can get all of that by dropping the right Instagram post. And if you've got enough followers, you're going to have to you're going to beat them off with a stick at the venue, you know. So I'm a little envious that way. I wish I had access to that kind of shit, you know. But I've already got two full-time jobs, you know, between running a comedy club and being a comedian. Man, fucking becoming an Instagram fucking fundi, you need to know your shit. And it's not as easy as it looks. I've got a page, you know, but it is a completely – and it's also a full-time job. You need to understand how these algorithms work. You need to understand why you've got the hashtag in front and where to post it, when to post it, how to post it. And, you know, I haven't put that polish on that particular product.
It's a different skill set, and you're right, because this is, you know, I remember – I have such a clear memory. What you guys do, like such an underappreciated art form – when you say like separate, if you put a professional next to an amateur, like putting you next to a guy who thinks he can tell some jokes, right? Because so much time has gone into craft. You know, I went to school with Alan Committee, and at school, when I was at school, he was a lighty, right? He did he did the sketch. I'll never forget. He did Rowan Atkinson's. I think it was like the devil, the speech in hell, whatever it was.
Oh, that's a great.
It wasn't that one? It was a wedding speech or something. A drunken wedding.
Okay. Yeah.
And I always looked at that and thought, that is fucking hilarious. I want to do that. And when I went to university, I studied drama, not because I wanted to do drama, because I wanted to do comedy. I thought that would be a fun thing to do. And the first piece I chose was that piece. And I spent months working on that piece, and I performed that piece, and it was a piece of shit. And I realized in that moment, motherfucker, there is so much that is going into the stuff. Yeah.
Man, this is the thing about stand-up. It's deceptively simple looking, you know? Because you look like, fuck, I can do that.
Jokes.
Yeah. But what you don't realize is now, I mean, I teach kids this all the time. I teach young comedians the basics of stand-up. And it's layered, man. There's about 20 layers in there. And the one is the way you use the
craft.
Yes, the word. Indeed.
Yeah.
You know, just how you use the microphone, close up, control the volume. When you never scream into the microphone, you always drop the mic far away from you when you scream. The way you use the stage, you know, that pregnant pauses, using them just the right moment, just before you drop a punchline, you know, those small little things like that. Pop, 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 pop. And, you know, it takes years of learning, and then you eventually get like, your style, your skill set, you get your voice. Because that only happened 10 years after I started, bro. I was just trying to survive it for the first 10 years. You know, you just go up there, you do your set, and you can run off. 10 years into it, I was like, oh, hold on a minute. I don't know what I'm going to say next, but let's go with it. Let's go with that. What's your name in the front row? Yeah, we'll fuck around with that a little bit. Well, and then a piece of comedy comes from that. It becomes part of your set, you know. So it's crazy, dude.
The art of improv is a fucking mystery. How you learn to improvise, or how you get comfortable in the uncomfortable.
Man, it is just that. It's that, like, Dave Levinson's, and in my opinion, he's the guy for that kind of shit. You know, when he's on stage, you'll watch all the comedians are watching. They're all of them are like, what is he doing? How is he doing that? Because he never seems to be using the same material over and over. A lot of us recycle pieces of material and say, Dave will talk about what's going on to fucking Dave, bro. What happened in the parking lot. And there's a confidence of not caring about failure, for example, that intrigues me. Because I gotta go and write this stuff and put some polish on it at home before I try it out on stage. There's certain pieces of it that are improvised, and it's like a waitress dropping a glass in the background type of deal, you know. Mm. But Dave would go up there without stringing one fucking net, eh? And he'll just do it. And I can't do that, eh? I can't do that. Exactly, he's jamming, bro. But with the English language, you know. And I'm in awe of that. I watched that. I'm like, what the fuck is he doing there? And then I turned to the rest of the guys. They're all watching, and I'm like, we fucking gotta kill him. We gotta just kill him. Just sort him out. He's making us all look cuck here. You know what I mean?
Oh man, I shot a pilot with him called the Davey Wavy Show. I don't know where it is. I'd love to find that. It was crazy. I think we did that like 25 years ago.
Dude, Dave did something at the Armchair Theatre when we started off that was legendary, called Agony Bomb and Dave. Have you heard of this?
It sounds familiar. Remind me.
Let me remind you. You came out there with a cow kind of waistcoat, man. It was like one of those, you unstem it, but with a cow theme. Right? Picture the scene. Note for note, but with a bucket of beers. And then you'd ask the audience for cuck that's going on in their lives. Like, you know, your missus is bumping the neighbor, I was parking in your spot every day. And he'll give you a beer if you've got a solid problem. And then you'll break it down and discuss it in front of everybody. Right? And you'll be fucking hilarious, dude. And I was always just wondering, how is he doing that? Because there's absolutely no way you could prepare for that. Absolutely no way. This, whatever was going on there was completely just what was going on there, you know? And he'd find a way to extract the maximum amount of funny from it. And I was just blown away by that. And I've been trying to get him to shoot that again, to put that on camera.
It seems like now is the perfect time. Like, that seems to be a sketch of the moment. That could work.
I'm telling you,
better than ever,
dude. That oak's got a rare talent where you can just wing the shit out of it, and it will just land in the right. Listen, he's not going to land every single time, and you know you got to cut it here and you got to cut it there a little bit. But I'll tell you what, there's going to be gems there, dude. Like you won't believe. I promise you. I just don't have the resources right now to do it. But you should do it, John. Shoot. Agony Bomb and Dave, make it happen. It'll be worth your while, dude.
I'm on it. Okay, two questions and then I'll let you go. Number one.
Shoot, my bro.
Teach me something about doing stand-up comedy. Something real.
Be honest. Always. You can't beat honesty. Honesty is the truth is the funniest shit, my bro. People always want to tell stories about, you know, I once met a guy that, no, fuck it, bro. Tell them what you're thinking right now. It's like, I am lank afraid of the dark. It scares the shit out of me. I don't know why. I can't explain it. But that's a great way to start the set, bro. Be vulnerable. Be honest. Call it straight, you know. The best material will come from that shit because they would relate to it. When I say they, the audience will. And you can tell the truth about it. It makes it a hell of a lot easier to approach, you know, instead of telling a story about something you heard somewhere along the line, because then it's a joke then, you know. And listen, I'm not saying there isn't funny material there, but I always say, go in there honest, go in there vulnerable, take the piss out of yourself, and then it's easy to do everyone else after that, you know.
Do you remember when and how you had to learn that lesson? Or was that just an act?
Man, I still learn that lesson all the time, you know. And there are times when, you know, you step up on the stage and you just step up with the wrong foot, bro, and you fuck it up. And listen, the audience wouldn't spot it because it's a subtle thing for me now, but I just didn't gel with that particular audience. And I know it. I can feel it, you know. I mean, they laughed at all the funny gags and stuff, but I didn't nail it. I can feel it, you know. And I'm learning those lessons all the time. I still am. Every time I go up on stage and I'm not feeling right about what it is that I'm saying and but it's a constant learning curve. It's like golf, bro. You're playing yourself. You never really get to fucking master the sport, no matter who you are, dude. Tiger Woods or not, you make such amateur fucking mistakes sometimes. You know, how the fuck did I do that? But being able to call it, I think, is the cool part, is when you can just be honest about it. And you know, when you fuck the gag up, you go, okay, I'll fuck that one up. How are we going to fix that?
Yeah, well,
I mean, you look at Eddie Izzard is great at that, right? He delivers a line that didn't go his way, or didn't go the way he wanted to, and he goes, oh, notice I don't do that one again.
I love it when he does that, when they don't laugh at a joke.
That's a great gag. That's the honesty I speak of, because then you people will buy whatever you're saying. Here's the thing about it, I think, right, is that individually you can fool anybody, I guess, but as an audience, a complete audience, they seem to have a collective consciousness, you know. They can detect bullshit a mile off. Mm. And if they're not buying, they're just like this. And no matter what, you can do that, fuck all, nothing. They just stare at you, bro. So once you're honest and you break it down and you share, they come to you, bro. Like the Pied Piper.
Favorite comedian in the world?
Ever.
Okay.
Okay. Richard Pryor.
Easy.
Why? Easy. I'll tell you why Richard Pryor, because he just fucking called it. No matter how fucked up it was, he called it. Like, you know that time he set himself alight? And when he came back a year later, his opening line was, if you see someone running down the road and they're on fire, put the fucking camera down and help me, bitches. You know, that is just the ultimate vulnerable, where you just go, I'm a fucking idiot.
And
they loved him for it, dude.
The way he used to talk about his drug, you know, his drug problems was fucking painful. Yeah. Painful, but man, so raw.
Man, that rawness. Chappelle, he's brilliant, dude. Chappelle just has a way of, you know, he's taken back this politically correct, this take at the politically correct space, the last show on Netflix, for example. It changed the way I did stand-up. I do stand-up now a little bit. It's enough for me to go, man, that's what I want to do. I want to do more of that shit. I want to, instead of pandering to what they're expecting to hear, where you actually change their shit, you know, where and you know, it's risky, because firstly, Chappelle, for example,
culture can kill you.
Oh, woke will fuck you up, my friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, woke will fuck you up, man. Lit and woke, that's it. A toe tag shit, that, my bro.
Favorite band or musician of all time?
Oh, of all time. Bro, that's a really tough one. I've got a vinyl collection of Note here as well. So I really love, I got so much stuff. But if I had to choose one band, wow, that's a really tough one. Man, you know who Curtis Blow is?
Of course.
I love Curtis Blow, bro.
Cool.
Fucking love that. I play that all the time, dude. I play that all the time. I like Hall & Oates as well. I play that all the time too. Completely underrated 80s band. And I like a lot of funk. Man, I like the old 60s rock, you know, Uriah Heep, Deep Purple, that kind of shit, man. I was weaned on that. My dad is an old hippie, I guess. You know, so I've got a big music love, dude. Bro, Touche, my friend. Covered all the bases there. Woof.
Favorite car?
That's
that
a tough
own,
one, bro.
Of your cars?
67 Camaro.
What color?
Black.
What's his name? Her name?
Don't have a name for it just yet, but she's not done yet either, you know.
Oh, cool.
That's going to be another year or two, but it's not in Bolt Rest of it, bro.
Amazing. And then finally, this is my closing question, and that is, recommend somebody you think should come on this show.
Dave Lev.
I thought you were going to say that. I'm happy with that. I'm going to take it.
Take that. Yeah, you should.
I will.
I think he'd make a great host, a great guest, in that he's gonna fuck your show up for you, but in the best way, bro.
Is that too much to ask for?
Yeah, bro. If you're lucky, you'll do that. And, yeah, I don't know. I sound like a Dave Lev fan, you know. It's fucking, but really, I think he's superb as a stand-up, and he's, you know, he's one of my best mates as well. But he's also just a bit fucking weird, you know. But I like that.
Very.
My style, that, you know.
Kurt, bro, I love you so much. Our lives have touched each other in very many ways along the thing, and I appreciate knowing you very much and bumping into you in the record store and always sort of touching based on stuff. I love that I wanted you to be my season 3 opening guest, because I've been wanting to have you on for a long time, but I wanted it to be...
I really appreciate you getting me on your show, and bro, I love your shit for like a million years, bro. We've always kind of seen the universe, I'd like to believe, from a similar kind of warped perspective. And over the years, we've stood back and watched the mayhem and gone, fuck it, dude, you check that cuck out there. And that's been valuable to me too, dude. And thanks for being a good guy and getting me on your show. And fuck it, hopefully with any luck, we can cause some more fucking carnage in the future, my friend.
Send me your Kurt for cars proposal. Kurt likes cars. Kurt loves, what's it?
Kurt loves cars.
That's what I said.
Bro, I've got your email, Eddie. I'll send it to you. I'd love you to have a squiz at it. Keep in mind that it's just a look and a feel right now, but I've got about 30 episodes written for this shit, dude.
Kurt Skunrad, what's your poison? Love you, bruh.
Thanks, my brother. As you were. Cheers, my dude.